Well, another aspect of these data that was quite surprising to us was the large number of people who we identified as having a first episode of psychosis who were not having contact with these early psychosis intervention services.
That's Dr. Kelly Anderson of Western University in Ontario, who will be joining us later in the podcast to talk about the benefits of an early psychosis intervention program, discussing findings from an article appearing in the May 2018 issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Other highlights from the May issue include treatment approaches in bipolar disorder, a chromosome problem linked to dementia, a randomized controlled trial of a new way to treat PTSD, and patterns of healthcare use prior to the diagnosis of a psychotic disorder. I'm Michael Roy, executive editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry, and this is AJP Audio. Leading off the May issue of the journal is a review article that is part of the journal's commemoration of its 175th year of publication. Each issue this year, a review article looks back at a key topic in psychiatry and places it in context for the clinicians of today and tomorrow. This month, Eduard Vieta from the University of Barcelona and colleagues examine early interventions for bipolar disorder. This is an area of great interest within psychiatry as the field gradually turns to prevention of mental illness. The progressive nature of bipolar disorder, with milder phases occurring prior to the classic onset of the disease, makes it an ideal candidate for early intervention strategies. A major strength of this review is that it focuses on longitudinal studies wherein temporality between risk factors or prodromal manifestations and bipolar disorder onset can be ascertained. Importantly, studies performed in both bipolar offspring samples and community cohort samples are included, making the results more representative. For the review, the researchers examined more than 50 original studies evaluating prodromal symptoms and risk factors, biomarkers, screening tools, and early intervention treatment options, including psychotherapeutic and pharmacological interventions for bipolar disorder. Bipolar disorder has high genetic loading. The single greatest risk factor for developing the disorder is having a parent with the illness, particularly one who had an onset of the disease before age 21. However, such children are also at increased risk for other psychopathology, such as major depressive disorder, anxiety disorder, or ADHD, rendering a correct diagnosis more challenging. Among the prodromal symptoms, the strongest predictor of conversion to bipolar disorder is subsyndromal manic symptoms. Young people with these symptoms tend to have recurrent episodes of hyperactive, silly, and disruptive behaviors at school and home, beyond what are expected for their age. Unlike children with ADHD, the problems of these children are not continuous. They may last a few months and then stop, only to emerge again later. Bipolar disorder is also influenced by a number of environmental risk factors, including stressful life events, sexual abuse, antidepressants, which can trigger mania, smoking, and substance abuse. Children with very high academic attainment may also be at greater risk for bipolar disorder. Choosing preventive medication treatments is particularly complex. The potential benefits of any pre-onset interventions must be carefully weighed against the risks of such treatment. Moreover, patients at risk for bipolar disorder might not convert to the full-blown illness. The authors recommend cautious use of pharmacotherapy and very gradual dosage escalations. Among the various types of psychotherapy examined, family-focused therapy provided longer stability and worked better at reducing symptoms of bipolar disorder than other forms of therapy. Clinicians can also help at-risk patients by screening for stressful life events and encouraging lifestyle modifications, including substance use cessation, physical activity, and healthy diet. The clinical case conference for May provides an example of a patient with genetic conditions that are linked to copy number variation. Copy number variation occurs when portions of the genome are repeated as copies, known as duplications, or where normal copies are absent, known as deletions. Patrick Sullivan from the University of North Carolina and his colleagues write about the case of a 41-year-old man. When the patient was in his 20s, he developed psychotic symptoms, which met DSM-5 criteria for schizophrenia. He was put on medications, which did not significantly help. By age 30, his medications were stopped. His condition deteriorated, and he experienced cognitive decline. He underwent further testing, including genetic analysis. This revealed a one-copy deletion on a region of chromosome 22, indicating 22q11 deletion syndrome. The testing also revealed a genetic repetition that indicates Huntington's disease. This case is informative because it details a patient with treatment-resistant schizophrenia who developed dementia. Moreover, the genetic testing indicated the patient had the rare combination of 22q11 deletion syndrome and Huntington's disease. It is estimated that this combination would occur in 1 out of every 40 million patients, or fewer than 10 cases in the United States. Both of these conditions are linked to increased risk of psychotic disorders. In reviewing this case, the authors note that patients with 22q11 deletion syndrome may also have autism, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and early onset Parkinson's disease. In addition, copy number variants linked to schizophrenia may also be linked to blood and immune problems. The authors note that mental health professionals don't need to become experts in genetic testing, but should be aware of symptoms that may indicate a co-occurring genetic disorder. Psychiatrists should be aware of the growing availability of genetic testing, which is being used more frequently to study the origin and treatment of disease. Knowing if a patient has genetic variants can also help connect families to support groups that are available for rare genetic syndromes. In addition, a thorough reevaluation of complex cases may lead to important breakthroughs with implications for diagnosis and treatment. We'll turn now to a randomized clinical trial evaluating a memory-related therapy for PTSD. In the study, Elaine Brunet from McGill University in Montreal and colleagues note that there is a need to improve treatment for PTSD. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, are commonly used, but they often have side effects that can make patients stop taking the medication. A recent different approach involves blocking the memory of traumatic events through exposure therapy, which aims to inhibit the expression of memories. One limitation of this approach is that it inhibits only the original fear-based memory and does not erase or reverse the initial memory. Therefore, the memory could return by way of impromptu renewal, reinstatement, or recovery. Here, Brunet and colleagues use a form of memory therapy in combination with a beta blocker, propranolol, in an effort to give patients a greater reduction in their PTSD symptoms. In the trial, 60 patients with PTSD were given either propranolol or placebo before they were told to recall their traumatic event. 1 hour after they took the medication, the participant was asked to write a one-page narrative of the traumatic event. After that, the participant read the narrative aloud to the therapist. This was repeated once a week for 6 weeks. Patients were evaluated on the clinician-administered PTSD scale and on a patient-rated checklist. The authors noted that at baseline, both patient groups had similar ratings on these scales. After the treatment, the scores in both groups had declined, but the group who had received propranolol had greater reductions on the patient-rated checklist. The effect sizes obtained for pre-reactivation propranolol in the study compare well to those obtained with cognitive behavioral therapy, the best evidence-based treatment for PTSD, and also compare well to effect sizes obtained with SSRIs, currently the most recommended pharmacological treatment for PTSD. If these results are confirmed in additional studies, this creative way of blunting the emotional content of traumatic memories could become a new, effective form of treatment for patients with PTSD. Next, a look at the patterns of healthcare use among young people who are later diagnosed with psychotic disorders. Psychotic disorders profoundly affect public health through disability, lost productivity, and greater mortality. New data indicate the value of early detection and intervention for first-episode psychosis. For example, data from the RAISE Early Treatment Program have indicated that a multi-component program involving psychotherapy, rehabilitation, and medication can reduce clinical symptoms and functional impairment. New work appearing in the journal this month comes from Gregory Simon and colleagues from health research organizations affiliated with the Colorado, Northern California, Northwest, Southern California, and Washington regions of Kaiser Permanente. The authors reviewed the medical records of all diagnoses made in youth and young adults, ages 15 to 29, between January 1, 2007 and December 31, 2013. During this period, they identified 624 confirmed cases of a first diagnosis of a psychotic disorder. For comparison, they also examined data from 1,862 patients who had received a diagnosis of first unipolar depression, and 1,851 comparison patients selected from all health plan members who had at least one outpatient visit during the study period. The authors sought to identify patterns of healthcare use prior to a first diagnosis of a psychotic disorder. The authors compare the patterns with those in the general population and with those who would receive a diagnosis of unipolar depression. Of the patients with the first diagnosis of a psychotic disorder, 29% have received mental health outpatient care in the previous year. 8% have received mental health inpatient care. 24% have received emergency department mental health care, and 29% made a primary care visit that involved a mental health diagnosis. Patients who received a first diagnosis of unipolar depression had similar rates of previous mental health outpatient or primary care visits, but the patients who later developed a psychotic disorder were far more likely to have received inpatient and emergency mental health services. Specifically, compared with patients receiving a first diagnosis of unipolar depression, those with a first diagnosis of psychosis were almost 3 times more likely to have received mental health inpatient care in the previous year, and well over 3 times more likely to have received mental health emergency department care. The strong and specific association between use of acute care mental health services and subsequent presentation with psychotic symptoms suggests the potential value of assessment for prodromal or early psychotic symptoms in people receiving inpatient or emergency care for mental health concerns. Systematic assessment following emergency department or inpatient mental health care may hasten identification and engagement in appropriate specialty care. Now we turn from early detection to early intervention, and Dr. Kelly Anderson joins us to talk about her article in the May issue that looked at the effectiveness of early psychosis intervention programs. Dr. Anderson is assistant professor at Western University in Ontario. She has appointments in the Department of Psychiatry and in the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics. She is also an adjunct scientist at the Institute for Clinical Evaluative Sciences. Her research interests include mental health and behavioral disorders, societal and cultural dimensions of health, and healthcare delivery. Hi, Dr. Anderson, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, your article looked at patients who had first episode psychosis who were treated through an early psychosis intervention program, and they were compared with patients who were not treated through that kind of program. But what did you and your co-authors find?
So we have really good evidence from randomized trials that early psychosis intervention programs are effective at improving both outcomes as well as patient satisfaction for young people with first episode psychosis. And what we wanted to know was, what is the impact of these programs in the broader health system context? So looking at these in a real world context when they're implemented as part of a broader healthcare system. And here in Canada, we have a universal public health insurance program, and we were able to access data from this program to look at people who'd used these early psychosis intervention programs and a comparison group of people who hadn't used these programs. And the program we were looking at specifically was the Prevention and Early Intervention for Psychosis program, known as PEP, which is located in London, Ontario. And when we looked at people who were using this program, we found that they had substantially lower rates of all-cause mortality compared with a matched group of young people with first episode psychosis who were not using these programs. We also found that these people had lower use of the emergency department for mental health reasons. And also found that they had higher rates of hospitalization and less use of primary care services.
Well, this is very good data. And what I was most struck by was the conclusion that you found that the people with the first episode of psychosis who used these services had mortality rates that were 4 times lower. That's quite a number, 4 times lower than those with first episode of psychosis who did not use these services. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah, and we were actually quite surprised by these findings too. And we have data from other studies that show that that first year after that initial diagnosis of psychotic disorder is a really high-risk time for patient mortality. Mortality in this first year is 24 times higher than the general population. And so we think that use of these services is reducing some of this high risk that we see early on in the course of psychotic disorder. And our findings actually suggest that we need to treat 40 people within an early psychosis intervention program in order to prevent one death.
What other aspects of your study are relevant for clinicians and other mental health professionals?
Well, another aspect of these data that was quite surprising to us was the large number of people who we identified as having a first episode of psychosis who were not having contact with these early psychosis intervention services. The number we estimate is as high as 50% of all young people with early psychosis who present to services within the program catchment area. And so I think it's important for clinicians and healthcare professionals to be mindful of the fact that these services exist and to be making sure that they are facilitating access to patients, to these services for patients who have first episode psychotic disorder.
Outstanding. And if you can tell us, what's next for you in your research?
Well, I'd like to expand this work to include the rest of the province of Ontario. So we're quite fortunate here in Ontario in that the government has chosen to invest quite heavily in early psychosis intervention. And we've rolled out this model of care across the province. So I'd like to look beyond London, Ontario, to see whether our findings are replicated in other early psychosis intervention programs across the province.
Well, here's hoping it will be. Well, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And this concludes our highlights of the May issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to ajp@psych.org. You can also rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to it. If you enjoy this podcast, APA Publishing has another one you might like. The Psychiatric Services From Pages to Practice podcast reviews the latest research published in the journal Psychiatric Services. It's hosted by the journal's editor-in-chief, Dr. Lisa Dixon, with her co-host, Dr. Josh Barrison. You can find it at the Psychiatric Services website, ps.psychiatryonline.org, as well as on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Next month in AJP Audio, we'll look at a unique form of episodic psychosis, the effect of early life stress on later health outcomes, healthcare use before an opioid-related death, new genetic markers for depression, and the effect of antipsychotic medication on the risk for diabetes in pregnancy. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.